Number 9752, Reel 1.
Colonel Norman Margrave Dillon, Reel 1. Could you tell me your date and place of birth, Colonel Dillon?
I was born on the 27th of July 1896 in Jesmond, which is a suburb of Newcastle upon Tyne.
What was your father's professional job?
He was the secretary to Palmer's Ironworks. Iron and Shipping Works, Jarrow, subsequently became Vickers Armstrong's.
Were you a large family?
I had two brothers and a sister.
And what sort of background would you describe it as?
Normal background.
Comfortably off?
Medium income, I would say. We had, for instance, a cook and a housemaid and two other maids in the house and a governess, or nanny.
Could you tell me something about your education? I believe you went to a local preparatory school first.
I went to local preparatory school, familiarly known as Crocs, from the texture of the skin of its headmaster, a man called Wilkinson, and from there I went on to Haileybury College, which is near Harford.
What sort of thing had you been taught at the prep school? What preparation did it give you?
Just the usual general education for the school certificate, in other words, the entrance certificate for Haileybury. Nothing, no specialised subject.
When did you go to Haileybury?
1910.
Could you tell me something about Haileybury, because we're quite interested in the public schools. Oh. Firstly, what the conditions that you lived there, what sort of conditions did you face there?
Well, it was originally the student college for the students of the East India Company, and it has many associations with India, and names of the houses, some of the people there who had worked in India in days gone by. It was fairly primitive. The dormitories, for instance, had bare boards on the floor, and in my day there were separate proper bathrooms, washrooms, and the bathing facilities were adequate. But the food was pretty primitive. Could not call it a luxury school, although I think many of the public schools are much the same. In fact, I believe at Eton, the bathing facilities were even less adequate.
What was your daily routine like?
We were out of bed at 7 o'clock in the morning, and down for chapel, the school chapel at 8:30. Following that, 7:45, there was the first lesson, breakfast at 8:30, second lesson, 9:15, and third, and so on until noon, when there was a break until 1 o'clock. Then the afternoon was filled until 4 o'clock by games of some sort, or a 7 mile run, and again up from 4 until 6 there were more lessons, ending up at 6:30 with supper. Consisted of bread, remains left over in baskets, and cocoa. Then after that came preparation for the next day's work, and into bed by 9:30 and lights out at 10 o'clock. I was in a house called Le Bar, since renamed Kipling, because Haileybury was joined together with the another school whose name escapes me. You cut it off, I can tell you.
What were the lessons that you were taught? What were the main subjects?
It depended which side you were on. If you were on the classical side, you had the normal English lectures and subjects, but the classical side had Latin and Greek thrown in. On the modern side, one had a much more modern approach, physics and chemistry, and I did a great deal of handicraft work in the workshops.
So you were on the modern side?
I was on the modern side.
What had decided you to go for the modern side as opposed to the classical side?
I had no bent for the classical side, and I was intensely practical as a boy, and liked using my fingers, and so I got on very well, and eventually when I left I passed out top of the workshop and engineering branch, side of the education.
What teaching methods were used in the classes?
Just the usual primitive methods. Translated things from French into English, and wrote essays about geography, mathematics, to follow the usual rules of education. I didn't get very far up the mathematical tree, but I managed to hold my own.
What about discipline? What was that like?
Discipline is pretty severe. The minor parts of the disciplinary conduct of the school were carried out by the prefects, and their word was law. If you were late in the dormitory, in fact, once I only got in as the clock was striking 10, but I got beaten for it just the same. So there was fairly strict discipline, and the prefects kept down ragging and bullying and so on. And you only got into trouble with your house master if your form master found you unbearable and wanted some discipline, and he'd give you a note to carry to the head to the house master, who'd give you the appropriate numbers of smacks with a stick.
Were these canings and thrashings, beatings, were they that very common, or would you largely?
No, I don't think so. I think most boys passed through Haileybury with only 2 or 3 beatings in their lives.
You mentioned ragging and bullying. Was the prefect kept it down? Does that mean there wasn't much of it about at Haileybury while you were there?
No, there wasn't much of it about. It's a natural instinct of school children to take the mickey out of anybody who looks a bit queer or differs from them. And of course, sometimes 2 or 3 would gather together, not realizing that they were making the life of the victim an absolute misery. And this, as a rule, was stopped by the prefects.
Did you have any trouble? Were you ever picked upon?
No. Can't say that I was. We had our fights, as all boys do, but there's nothing exceptional about it.
Had the fagging system been abolished by then, or was there any informal?
Well, the fagging system was in full growth then.
Could you describe it?
Well, an excellent system it was, too. I know, for instance, coming out from breakfast to walk to your house across the quad, sometimes you would hear the shout from across the quad, "Fag! Fag!" And every boy who was due to be a fag had to run. And the last one to get there got the job, which might be to go down to the grub shop and buy something, or collect some books, or get some boots from the bootmakers, or what have you.
You say every boy who was liable to be a fag. Which boys were liable to be fags?
As a rule, after your first year, you were free. But the first 3 terms, you were subject to this tyranny.
When you were a fag in the first year, were you attached to any particular older boy, or were you just at the general beck and call of anybody senior?
No, at Haileybridge we were just at the beck and call of anybody senior. And if in your dormitory, for instance, a senior prefect wanted a fag, he would call fag, and any boys who were in the dormitory and who were liable to service had to trot along quick to his bed, see what he wanted.
Were the boys in the dormitory of mixed ages then?
Oh yes, yes. They arrived mostly at the age of about 14 and left mostly at the age of 17 or 18. That's the
Now, you mentioned that the afternoons were devoted to sport. Was sport very important at Haileybury?
Oh, very important indeed. In fact, the main aspiration, I think, above classical knowledge and work, was to become a member of the 15. And I much regret to say it's the biggest disappointment in my life that I failed to make it by one, because my nose was broken the day before a crucial match, and I would undoubtedly have had my colours. And so by one nick I missed it, and I was too old to stay on another year to get the colours, so they're forever gone.
So it was rugby football during the winter. What was the summer game? Cricket?
Rugby football during the winter, association football and hockey, and some rugby during the spring term, and cricket in the summer term.
Did you play all of these reasonably well?
Yes, I played them all pretty well. I'm not much good at cricket because I haven't got a ball striking eye, and that's why I'm not much use at tennis. But I got on fine at squash, because the squash rackets, you haven't got time to adjust. You've got to hit and hope for the best.
Was there much competition between the houses at sport? Or
tremendous competition, yes. For a cup which was called the Cock House Cup, and the houses used to compete with tremendous enthusiasm against each other.
Was this competition purely sporting, or was there an academic side to competition?
No academic side to it, purely sporting. Academics were rather a class apart. I think that's how they all are in all institutions. And they would take such part in sport as they were obliged to do, and would look on interestedly at any other games that were going on, but not too keen to do anything themselves. You can't blame them, after all.
What about the officers' training corps? Did you have one at Haileybury?
Oh yes, had an officers' training corps. I'm glad to say, because apart from having been a Boy Scout in my youth, and the officers training corps, I had absolutely no training at all when I was commissioned to the outbreak of World War One.
Could you tell me about your training in the OTC?
It was very sporadic. Once a week we used to turn out and form fours and march up and down. And once a year we used to go on manoeuvres, which were completely meaningless, fire off a few blank rounds. But it was a day out, and we used to go by train to Hatfield Park. Well, I don't think anybody knew what they were doing, least of all the masters who were supposed to be organising us. But it was all great fun.
What sort of things did you do on these manoeuvres?
Simply ran like hares and lay down the grass and let off blank rounds. An enemy that was supposed to be there, and an umpire would gallop up and say, "You're all dead here, retreat, off you go." So we form fours and march away again. All rather absurd.
Were these manoeuvres in coordination with other OTC groups from other public schools, or were you on your own?
Oh no, there are other schools involved. I forget which ones. Berkhamsted, I think, was one. But I don't think we're allowed to get too close, because the boys were apt to get a bit too excited and might do each other an injury if the thing led to close fighting.
You mentioned the drill training that you had. At what level of sophistication did the drill get to? Or was it just forming fours?
As far as I remember, it was just forming fours and turning a fours into a square. Nothing very involved.
And you say this was sporadic? There wasn't a special drill section each day or each week?
Once a week we used to turn out. In the afternoon, I think, for an hour.
Who gave the drill commands? Was there an old regular, or was it just, or who?
There was an ex-regular sergeant on the school staff, and I think he was, in addition to the gymnasium, I think he took part in training the OTC training.
You say you used to fire off the odd round of blank ammunition.
Yeah.
Were you actually trained at all in how to fire a rifle properly, or were you just handed the rifle?
Oh no, we were trained how to do it properly. I don't think that we... I don't remember firing on the range.
Where would you fire?
I suppose we must have had to fire, because there was a rifle range at Haileybury where the shooting eight used to train for shooting at Bisley against other schools.
You weren't involved in that, though?
I wasn't involved in it. Although I could shoot a miniature rifle, all right, I knew that. But as far as I remember, we weren't taken down to the range. Perhaps it was a good thing.
How many of you were there in the OTC group?
I'd say 300.
Did you attain any rank other than private?
No, I never did. I was too young.
Did you enjoy the OTC activities?
Can't say yes or no. I just did it because I was told to.
Who told you to do it? Was it compulsory?
No, it wasn't compulsory. But my parents said I should join, because my brothers had been at Haileybury before me and they had all been members of the OTC, so my parents thought I should follow suit.
Now, you went to Haileybury in 1910. How did you come to leave Haileybury?
In the ordinary course of life, my lifespan there had finished. Also, my father got an offer from a ship-owning friend of his to offer me a free trip to the East in one of his liners. He was the owner of the Prince Line. These ships ran through the Mediterranean to Port Said and Palestine generally. And my father thought it a splendid opportunity for me to see a bit of the world for nothing. And so I set forth on this voyage.
So you left school in 1913, would that be correct?
1913, yes, that's right.
And you went straight off in this voyage?
I went straight off in this voyage.
Before we come to the voyage, you mentioned something earlier I'd like to pick up on. You said you were in the Scouts. You must have been a very early Scout. Could you tell me how you became involved in the Scouting movement?
I read the book Scouting by Boys, and it took my imagination, and there to several of my other friends at the prep school, and it was the date would be about 1908, and we got together, eight of us, and formed a troop. I had great difficulty in finding a scoutmaster to take charge of us, and we found one, a builder, who very unwillingly let us use his builder's yard, the place to rampage about in. And we got the uniforms, set ourselves up, and we used to go out camping and do all the things that are listed in Scouting for Boys. And this was called the First Jesmond Troop. I don't know if there are any records of it now. We had to have a flag with the name of a creature on it, so we chose the peewit, which is a well-known North Country bird, green plover.
How was the troop financed?
By our parents. They bought the uniforms, and there was no other money. We weren't financed like the present-day scouts who have money poured out on them in halls and machinery and equipment of every sort. We had to find our own and make do. Those are really early days.
What was the uniform your parents bought for you?
The standard scouts uniform, the felt hat, the wide brim, the khaki blouse, shorts and stockings, and a broomstick. I'm not sure yet what the purpose of the broomstick was, but you could use it for all sorts of things like tent poles and making into stretchers and so forth.
Could you run through, you say you did most of the activities in Scouting for Boys, could you run through what some of those activities were?
Lighting fires, cooking and doing so in such a manner as to leave no trace behind of dirt or rubbish, getting to know bird calls, what sort of birds look like, tracks, which tracks were what, where rabbits went during the day, the habits of other animals. Then we got a certain amount of first aid. I think some of that from my sister, who was studying medical things, first aid. So bandaging people, ability to make a stretcher out of two broomsticks and two jackets, and then putting the sticks through the sleeper armholes. I think that about covers everything.
Did you get a scoutmaster in the end?
Oh, yes, we got one or two. They used to get bored and go off.
Was there much drilling involved?
Not very much. The only drilling involved was what we arranged ourselves in order to march about in an orderly fashion, going from our school, say, to the place where we were going to camp. And they had to walk, or we would march there. And the amount of drilling wasn't necessarily a great deal.
Do you feel now that the your scouting activities, that there was a military tinge to it, or was it just good fun?
I wouldn't say it was a military tinge. It is an extremely useful education. Because so many of the things that I did as a scout, I was only too glad to know about in World War I.
What sort of things? Can you just...
Cooking in the open, for instance. How to clean your cooking gear after using it. Making a shakedown in the woods. How to find warm things to lie upon.
So the camping side of it?
Camping side of it. Oh, yes, it's tremendous. We used to find our way about by compass, and that is of extreme value to me in World War I. I had to very often take parties of men a mile perhaps in the black night with absolutely no landmark whatever to go by, and I was able to do it by compass, thereby getting a reputation for having some form of witchcraft. But other people running about, I was meeting other parties running about lost, saying, "Where are we?" And the cry on the Somme battle, for instance, was inevitably the parties, men in the dark, "Lost again, lost again." You could hear it all round you like a kind of refrain from some nocturnal animal. And I always managed to get through with my compass.
Did you have any contact with other early scouting bodies in the northeast? Because they were setting up all through the northeast at that time. Did you ever meet any of the others?
No, we were the only one. The only one until I left to go to Haileybury.
Did you continue your scouting involvement after you got to Haileybury?
No, there was no object after that. There was no scout troop at Haileybury, and there's no point in continuing it. When I came home for the holidays, for instance, I found that all my fellow scouts had dispersed. The whole thing had broken up. I don't know what happened to the troop, whether it went on under a different aegis after I left, but I don't know.